Glass doors flanked the revolving door entrance to the lobby. A dead soldier's body hung out of the door on their left. His face was down, touching the stone entrance. A helmet was still strapped to his head. He held a large rifle. Todd did not know guns. He assumed it was an M16. That was the only army-type assault rifle he knew. "He was shot from behind," Todd said, pointing to the tears in the back of the man's shirt. "There was a fight inside, too." They walked through the broken glass door on the right side of the revolving door. It was dark and cool inside, cooler than it was outside. The stone walls and floor of the museum held the winter cold like ice blocks in an old refrigerator. Todd put his shotgun down and unslung his backpack. He took out two headlamps, handing one to Solange while slipping the other on his head. He pulled out two flashlights, giving one to Solange. He slung the backpack, stood up, and asked, "Where to?" Solange looked around the room.
"It looks like there are temperature stations there."
She pointed to a bank of tables near the entrance. "The people were moved into two areas for provisions." Her flashlight highlighted signs posted over two doorways. One sign read "healthy" and the other "sick." "I suggest we ignore this and head to the European exhibits." Todd was more interested in locating art than solving the mystery of the gunfight.
"I do not need to see more death. I would like to see a Picasso."
Solange focused her flashlight beam on the stairs to the second floor. "Let's grab a museum map and try to steal some art. I hope we can salvage something out of this mayhem. What a waste. They all would have died anyway, but they would have died at peace. What could they have been thinking?" Todd shook his head as he bent down to pick up one of the hundreds of museum maps scattered around the lobby. His headlamp provided reading light. "Looks like we need to go up the stairs and to the left. European art, here we come." The cold museum interior acted like a morgue freezer and protected the bodies from decomposition. Todd and Solange stepped over a soldier whose body blocked the top of the stairs. There were bullet holes and marks all along the staircase. The dead soldier was shooting down at the front doors. He had bloody spots on his back where he was shot from behind. His body fell to the top of the landing. "Poor bastard," Todd said as he stepped over him. He thought he was holding the line, and whoever was attacking came in another door and hit him from behind. They continued to the top of the stairs, his flashlight leading the way. They entered the first gallery, and their hearts sank.
"It is destroyed," Solange said sadly.
Bullet holes filled the walls and pictures. Frames lay on the ground, smashed and ruined.
"The fight took everything with it."
"Europe is pretty far from the center of the museum. Maybe the wings did not see as much fighting," Todd said hopefully. The destruction to the art and building decreased as they moved away from the stairs and main hallways. Bodies, however, were scattered throughout the museum. Blood, long since dried, left black circles on the floors and smears against the walls. Solange and Todd entered the first room of European art. There were knife cuts through most of the paintings.
"My God, these are Monet's. Who would do this? Why? Why would you do this?"
Todd lost his composure.
"It seems like they were fighting for food and water, fighting for their lives, but then to come in and cut up the art? This shows contempt for humanity."
They walked around the first two rooms. Todd stopped in front of a Monet haystack. His eyes dropped, and he shook his head. There were crude rips through the painting made with the nose of a rifle or gun. Several spots on the wall were vacant. Art thieves had beaten Solange and Todd. Todd wondered if the paintings were taken before, during, or after the attack.
"Let's keep going and think positively," Todd encouraged.
He moved towards the room on his right. He and Solange relied entirely on their flashlights and headlamps to make their way through the pitch-black and windowless gallery. Todd pointed his flashlight beam on a picture as soon as he walked through the doorway. A Monet, water lilies, hung without damage, pristine as it was before the rapture. "This is going to sound pretentious, but I'm not a Monet person. I get why people love his work, but I am not a fan, and if I have limited ability to carry,
I'll stick to other works. Todd felt funny passing on a Monet.
If one of the others would like it, they can come back through and pick it up, Solange said.
Still, she walked to the painting, studying the work.
I like it. I will start with it. I will see if something else is in good condition. Maybe this Monet is all we will be able to save.
Good point. We can always leave it if we find something else. They continued through a door to the next room, not hesitating to enjoy the gallery. They came for Picasso's and Van Gogh's. The violent deaths robbed them of any desire to gallery stroll, as did the smell of rotting death. The odor was weaker in the building, but still present in the air. Todd's light beam pointed at the first painting in the room. It was the Van Gogh Todd wanted, the one he dreamed about since seeing it 10 years earlier during his first visit to the Metropolitan. Todd rushed ahead, almost tripping over the large wooden benches bolted to the floor. The art label read, Wheat Field with Cypresses, Vincent Van Gogh, 1889. Todd never enjoyed or paid attention to art. 10 years earlier, he visited New York with Emily while she was on a business trip. Stuck by himself while she was in meetings for the day, he went into the Metropolitan to kill time. He strolled through the galleries, nodding at some pieces, walking briskly past most. When he saw the Van Gogh, he was floored. The colors and textures, always muted by photographs and books, were incredible. They were alive and unlike anything Todd had seen before. He sat on the bench in front of the picture, Wheat Field with Cypresses, for 15 or 20 minutes. He could not get enough of the painting. He yearned for other Van Goghs, visiting exhibits in any major city he knew had works by the artist. Todd reached out and touched the frame. It was flush against the wall, not hanging from a wire or nail in the wall. Todd put the flashlight and shotgun on the bench facing the picture. He grabbed the frame on each side and pushed up. The picture began to move, kept on the wall by a tongue-and-groove system.
"That is the one we came for?" Solange asked.
"Yes," Todd said, looking at the large picture with the light of his headlamp.
"I am going into the next room. If we do not find a Picasso, I would like to leave. The stench is too much for me. It is getting stronger in these rooms."
Before she turned to go through the archway to the left, she held up the Monet she was carrying.
"May I leave this here?" she asked.
Todd was lost in his new treasure, but snapped out of it to answer her.
"Oh, yeah, of course. Sorry. I'll bring it."
She set the painting down next to him, leaning it against the bench as she left for the new room. Todd prepared for the walk back to the RV. Solange was correct. The smell was unbearable. They found and collected some art. It was time to call it a day. He was eager to report to the group about the firefight and destruction. Todd set his painting down, leaning it against the Monet. He turned off his flashlight, deciding to use his headlamp the rest of the way, freeing his hands to carry paintings. He put the flashlight into his day pack and put the pack on his back. He used the shoulder strap on the shotgun and slung it behind him. He tightened the scarf around his mouth in an attempt to block out the smell before joining Solange in the next room. Her flashlight beam was focused on a painting, a man at a table feeling for a pitcher. The imagery was powerful.
"It is beautiful. It is more than I expected. I would like to take this one and the Matisse I already pulled off the wall."
She moved her flashlight beam to a picture of flowers.
"My father loved Matisse. It will remind me of him."
She turned the beam back to the Picasso.
"This will remind me of what the world was like when we were able to enjoy art. Maybe it will inspire a survivor to become an artist, if we reach a time when we can be idle again and the world can create artists."
"You were one serious young woman, Solange. We'll have idle time again. It might not be in the next few years, but when we've found a place to live, when we've found other people, when the engineers of our new world, people like you, help to rebuild some of the mechanics of society, people will paint again." They admired the Picasso. "Until there are painters, these pictures will get us through."
"I agree."
She nodded, and her headlamp beam bounced up and down on the wall. Let us follow my bouncing ball and get away from this horrible place. I cannot stand the smell any longer.
Todd laughed at the bouncing ball joke. Maybe Solange was not as serious as she let on. She carried the Matisse, and Todd managed with the other three frames. According to the map, they were near a back emergency exit of the museum. They walked through several archways until they saw daylight peeking through the bottom of a door. A sign above the door read, Exit. Todd turned the handle and walked into the stairwell. The powerful smell almost knocked him back.
Oh my God, he said as he held the door open for Solange.
We might have to go back through the front.
Her eyes squinted from the smell as she came through the door sideways with the large painting. The window at the top of the stairs was shot out. Glass lay on the ground. The smell came through the hole. Solange walked to the gap and looked towards the park behind the museum. Leafless trees should have displayed softball fields and open spaces. Instead, Solange saw a large hole in the ground. Flocks of carrion swirled around and on top of the pile. Solange turned her face away from the image. Tears formed in her eyes.
What is it?
Todd asked. He saw the torment on her face. He was holding his three paintings and did not look through the broken glass.
Go back. We have to go out the front. We cannot go out this way.
She was crying and scooted around Todd as he held the door open. Todd put his paintings on the floor and walked to the glass. The door shut behind him. Rancid air blew through the broken window's opening. He saw what affected Solange. There were tens of thousands of bodies, maybe hundreds of thousands. They filled a hole the size of a football field and were piled as high as a 3- or 4-story building. Birds feasted on the remains.
Good Lord, Todd muttered.
He saw more evidence of the gunfight. Men in fatigues lay dead outside the back door. Bodies in street clothes poked from behind trees and a nearby dumpster. Todd shut his eyes, took stock of the scene, and turned to leave. The door was locked from the inside. He knocked for Solange. He saw the door handle turn. A composed Solange held the door for him.
May we go now? She asked solemnly.
I cannot go fast or far enough. Todd picked up the paintings and they made their way out of the Metropolitan Museum of Art. They pulled the scarves from their faces when they were close to 71st Street.
That was the worst thing I have ever seen, Todd said to her.
I will never see anything as horrible again. Those birds eating the rotting flesh. How can a place that held all the beauty of humanity become such a nightmare? What happened? Why was the army there? I did not hear anything about a gunfight in New York City. I listened to the news every day.
Solange maintained a quick pace towards their camp, despite the poor conditions in the ice and snow. I don't think we'll ever know. Todd paused, stopping to look at her.
And you know what? I don't think I want to know.
29. The U.S. government's initial takeover of the media was not nefarious. Television networks were devastated by the pandemic. Broadcast journalists fell to the rapture immediately, exposed to it sooner than the general population by foreign correspondents returning from assignments. The president needed information distributed. He appointed an Office of Information and used the military to control television and radio networks. There was no cure for the rapture. The population was dying at an increasing rate, and the major cities were crumbling. As the pandemic worsened, the Office of Information became a tool for control. The country was in critical shape. The new edict from the Secretary of Information was to broadcast positive stories and non-specific information. The Secretary assumed control of the Internet and social media outlets in an attempt to positively spin all rapture messaging. The battle at the Met, as it was called by the few survivors of the fight, occurred after the government media takeover. The event did not qualify as positive and was kept out of the news and off the Internet. The CDC theorized it could derive and synthesize a cure from healthy, immune citizens, and it used the military to locate and detain those citizens. The military lured people to community meetings with the promise of food, water, and information. Body temperature scanners identified healthy people. Healthy citizens, typically pulled aside from the main meeting, could volunteer to assist in testing or be forcibly volunteered. The program yielded no results. Those captured either contracted the rapture within days or died from the disease without developing a high fever. As the military continued to take custody of individuals, the population became suspicious. Information events were held at libraries or other public spaces. New York City suffered a food and water shortage almost immediately, and the promise of supplies brought large crowds. The military events held at the Metropolitan were popular. The attendees, many of whom went regularly, began to notice people with low temperatures were disappearing. The military, pressured to find as many healthy people as possible, became sloppy in their kidnappings. The government believed the end, a cure, would justify any means. When an 8-year-old girl was taken from her family, New Yorkers organized to end the kidnappings at the Metropolitan. The initial attempt at halting the government was an old-world response. People arrived at the Metropolitan with protest signs, blocking entry to the museum and scanners. The military arrested all of the protesters, locking them in a containment facility. "We have rights. You can't do this to us," a detained lawyer argued. "Do you want to die here, or do you want to die in your home with friends and family? That is your choice. I am releasing you in 1 hour, but we have your names and photos. If you try to stop our programs again, you won't be released. No one will ever see you again." The cold certainty in the sergeant's voice told the captives it was not an idle threat. The people in the containment area exchanged names and set up a meeting. They organized a different kind of protest, one which would end the public roundups immediately. The military doubled their presence at the Metropolitan, but they were not prepared for the assault. 20 military personnel fought hundreds of armed citizens. Despite their superior weaponry, the sheer number of attackers doomed the soldiers. The battle at the Met was bloody and shocking. Bodies of citizens and soldiers lined the steps and corridors of the museum. Riots erupted on the Upper East Side of Manhattan. Buildings were set on fire. Military vehicles were attacked. The army had no response, and no ability to stop the uprising. The neighborhood around the museum burned for days. 30. Solange and Todd saw the black smoke of the signal fires as they approached the camp. The kids were watching a movie in one of the RVs, while Melanie and Emily supervised. "Looks like you made out," John said to his brother, walking towards them with a smile on his face. "You're back sooner than I thought. Did you see everything you wanted to see?"
"Did Emily tell you about the smell that chased her from the science museum?"
Todd's face was serious.
"You let a little smell scare you away? Come on, bro."
"It was a mass grave. There were tens of thousands of bodies." Todd turned to Solange. "Maybe more?" he asked her.
"I did not look at it for more than a second, but yes, there were hundreds of thousands of bodies. And birds."
She shook her head.
"The birds were horrifying."
Todd continued. "We shouldn't go north of here again. Maybe 3 or 4 blocks, but nothing more. I say we check out the Statue of Liberty tomorrow, the Empire State Building, and leave. There's no one here."
John was confused. "I get why no one would live up there, but there might be people in Lower Manhattan. We need to give this a shot."
"Let me put this art away, and we will tell you what else we saw." Todd went into the RV to say hello to Emily. He asked her and Melanie to step outside. The kids cheered when they saw Todd, but quickly returned to their movie. Todd could not compete with Jim Carrey. Todd and Solange recounted their experience at the Metropolitan to the circle of adults. Peter was the first to respond.
"I read about that whole thing towards the end of the rapture. I guess I forgot about it, or maybe thought it was a hoax. We didn't have anything like that in D.C. I assumed it was fiction.
I'm sorry, guys. Sorry I sent you up there without even thinking about it.
The group stared at Peter.
Wait, what?
You knew about the gunfight and you didn't say anything?
Todd was not upset. He was stunned.
Well, kind of, but not really. I was very into the computer in my last few years. I read everything I could, had some deep blog contacts. There was an email that circulated. The government shut down the actual internet. Hell, you couldn't even use the text part of an email. You had to write what you wanted in an attachment, cover it with innocuous things in the body. Anyway, I was getting a newsletter, happenings around the country. Some of it was crap. I mean, I lived in Washington, and the newsletter would say the White House is in flames. When I read there was a firefight at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, well, it made no sense. I put it in the fiction category.
Did the letter say why it happened? Did it talk about the mass grave in the park?
Todd was interested in these newsletters, as was the rest of the group. The letters might hold the key to survivors' locations.
The newsletters always talked about healthy people being snatched up, about how no one should attend the government information sessions or food giveaways, that everything was a ruse to identify and take healthy people.
Peter could tell he was losing the group.
I told you some of the information was hard to believe.
Your newsletters claimed the government was rounding up healthy people?
Why?
John believed the newsletters, and he could sense Peter was uncomfortable talking about the conspiracies.
There was one post from a woman who lived in Dallas. She attended a government wellness meeting because she needed water and food. She had a normal temp. They asked her to come into the next room, and she met with a younger man in fatigues who asked her to volunteer to come with him. He was asking anyone who was healthy to volunteer to be tested in the hopes of finding a cure. He told her that his orders were to take people by force, but he didn't want to follow orders. She told him that she had two children at home that were sick and still needed her and the food and water she was bringing back. The man told her to never attend another wellness clinic, to take the food and water from her neighbors or anywhere else, but never trust the government. The army man pulled a digital thermometer out of his pocket, stuck it in his mouth, waited for the beep, and handed it to her. He said to show the people at the desk the new reading and tell them she failed his follow-up exam. The temperature read 102. She thanked him, told him God bless, and she finished the seminar to get her food and water.
Peter stopped. After a long pause, he continued.
Well, the army people in New York City were not as moral as the young man in Dallas. They were taking people, and were not smooth about it. After a group of protesters were arrested, the city went crazy. There was a post about the Upper East Side being engulfed in flames, and riots occurring around all of the military armories and stations. It was an unbelievable story, like the ones about D.C. I assumed they were false. There were several posts about a gunfight at the Metropolitan Museum of Art between the army and a group of attackers rushing the guards, shooting people, taking the museum, trashing art, burning buildings, stealing the food. None of it made sense.
Everyone was quiet. Matt asked the obvious question.
Do you still have these emails? Did you bring your laptop or tablet? I'd like to read them.
Peter nodded.
They're all on my computer. We just need to charge it.
Melanie looked at Peter.
You are full of surprises. Why didn't you ever share with me? 4 months together and you never mentioned any of this.
Some of the past needed to stay in the past. What did it matter? I didn't want you to think I was some conspiracy loon, which I probably am. I saw too much in the military to not be suspicious.
He turned to Todd and Solange.
I'm sorry I didn't warn you. It honestly slipped my mind. I hope it wasn't too horrible.
Solange put her hand on his shoulder.
It was horrific, but I am okay. You are right. The past is the past. I wanted the Matisse, and I feel like I earned the painting.
Did the writings say anything about the mass grave?
Todd wanted to peek at those emails, too.
Every city had mass graves, Peter said solemnly. I saw the one in D.C. The sheer volume of corpses was staggering. I would think New York would pick a better spot than Central Park, but I guess not. No, I didn't know it was there, but I knew there would be one somewhere.
John moved to more practical questions. Do you think any of the people on your email string stayed alive? Do you know where anyone is?
I don't know if anyone is alive, but probably not. No one mentioned a specific location. We assumed the email was being monitored.
If you're looking for a post that says, "We're leaving Manhattan for Montauk," you're not going to find it.
No one would give up that kind of specific information for fear it was being tracked.
John nodded. Do we have a new plan? Do we think we're wasting our time in New York City? We can drive down to the statue, take a look, and drive up to Boston. Not a problem for me.
Peter was the first to speak.
I would like to give it at least one full day. I want to walk down to St. Patrick's and light a candle for my wife and children, and one for the world. I will come back and man the fire and blow the horns tomorrow. I vote to give New York City 2 days.
We can go to Ellis Island tomorrow, Emily said excitedly. I bet we can find a boat or something to get us over there.
Are you crazy? John responded. It's freezing. It's windy. How the hell are we going to find a boat to take us to Ellis Island?
Don't try and talk her out of it. She is crazy, Todd said to John.
Todd received a punch on the shoulder, along with a laugh, from his wife. 5 minutes after the adult meeting, the kids emerged from the RV. A full tribe soccer match began in the park. Todd bowed out to make chili and cornbread, while the rest of the group chose sides. The temperature was brisk. Laughter and screaming echoed off the buildings around the park. New York City, silent for too long, welcomed the raucous match. The air filled with the aroma of dinner as Todd opened the door of the RV to place the chili on a picnic table. He set the pot down and watched the soccer.
"Excuse me?"
Todd heard a meek female voice.
"My name is Kelly. I'm so hungry. May I have some of your soup?"
Todd spun around to face a woman in her mid-twenties. Her face was dirty, and she was thin. Her legs and arms were sticks in her jeans and top. Her cheeks were sunken and sallow. Tears ran down her face and made tracks in the grime. Todd could not help but notice she wore beautiful designer clothes.
"Of course. My God, please sit down. My name is Todd. Todd Dixon."
He ladled the large portion of chili into a paper bowl and offered her a seat with the food.
"Sit down. Eat. You're with friends now. Anything we have, just ask."
He handed her a paper cup of hot chocolate.
"Would you like to eat inside, out of the cold?"
The woman said nothing. She ate ravenously. When she was done, she looked at Todd with thankful eyes.
"Would you like more?"
"There's plenty." He could tell she was still hungry, but was afraid to ask.
"Please."
Her eyes streamed tears of joy and relief. The rest of the group stopped their soccer game and stared at Todd and the stranger. John kept the crowd away to give the starving woman space. Jay broke from the group and ran over to the woman.
"Hello," he said, extending his hand. "My name is Jay Dixon. I'm 6. What's your name?"
"Hello, Jay Dixon," she said, taking his hand.
"My name is Kelly Maddox. I'm 28.
"This is my dad, Todd,"
Jay said, flipping his thumb over his shoulder in Todd's direction.
"Your father makes excellent chili, and is a very generous man," Kelly said.
She stood and offered her hand to Todd.
"Thank you for your kindness."
The rest of the group walked over to meet her.
"Before I introduce myself, I'm on a scavenging mission for a group of survivors living in a seminary near Chelsea. There are 11 of us, and we need food desperately."
"Okay," Todd started. "What's the age range of the group?"
"We have 3 children, 3 teens, 5 adults. One of the adults is in her late 60s.
Kelly drank a cup of hot chocolate as she answered the questions. Todd made her a double mug as she ate the chili. "Should we move down there or send a party to pick them up while I make food?" Kelly paused.
I think you should have us come up here. I can go down with a few of you to pick up the group. We have a van. We don't use it because of the snow.
John cut in on their conversation. Is there anyone we should be worried about bringing to our camp? The question hung in the air. Look, I will help anyone. None of us asked for this situation, but you didn't hand-pick the 10 people you survived the rapture with. I have 2 sons and 2 nephews and 3 other children I have grown fond of in the last week. We have young women. I would like to know if you think there's anyone in your group I should be keeping an eye on.
Emily was annoyed John asked the question in front of the children, but she was glad he asked the question. She could sense Kelly was intimidated by John's forward manner. She added to his question,
"We're going to give you food. Don't even think not getting food is an option. I'm a mother. You met my son, Jay. Please let us know if you think there's someone we should be worried about."
Kelly dropped her head.
"I don't trust Sal. He's stoned most of the time. He's a big guy, worked construction. His hands are scarred from years of hard labor. He's a pill popper. I'd keep an eye on him. I think he wants to steal things and run away, which would be fine with me. He's not around much, but you'll be able to tell right away if he's at the seminary. He must have been a scam artist or grifter before all of this. I swear he's still looking for an angle. The rest of us have figured out there are no angles anymore." She looked back up at the group.
"The rest of us, me and the other 9, we're good people.
Well, one of the teens is a punk, but he has a good heart." She pleaded with Emily.
"Please help us. We need water as much as we need food. We drink dirty snow and rain puddles."
Kelly dropped her face. The 8 days together honed the new tribe into a well-oiled machine. The Dixon family and the Washington, D.C. family sprung into action. Melanie, Todd, Matt, and Emily elected to stay with the children. John, Solange, Peter, and Craig would take Kelly to Chelsea, meet her clan, and invite them back to the park for dinner. The decisions were made quickly, and the greeting party prepared for a drive down 5th Avenue. Craig was excited to meet the new people. His father pulled him aside.
"Craig," John started, "you're an important part of this group. We want the kids to feel safe and excited to come with us. Make sure you're friendly. Let's get you a bag of candy, maybe some lollipops or something that you can hand out."
Craig nodded, keeping focused as his insides danced with excitement.
"You won't need candy," Kelly overheard. "Bottles of water are needed more than lollipops or candy bars."
Craig was handed a box of juice pouches. Peter walked to his fishing buddy, Craig.
"You and I are the 2 friendly faces in our group. Your dad and Solange are serious enough for the 4 of us."
The old man laughed, rubbing Craig's hair like old men like to do.
"I can be nice. I just have not found people I would like to be nice to yet," Solange said to Peter, smiling at the tall white-haired gentleman.
The young woman and old man continued to trade one-liners as Craig opened the door to the truck and moved into the 3rd row. Craig examined the new woman sitting in the 2nd row. She did not say anything. She sat in the Suburban and stared. The SUV was on and warm inside. The woman leaned her head back, enjoying relief from her hunger and cold for the first time in months. Craig liked her, even though he had not spoken to her yet. She had a kind face and long, pretty blonde hair. Her hair was filthy, but beautiful. It stuck through the back of a Minnesota Twins baseball cap, dangling into the 3rd row area. Kelly turned around to look at Craig.
"Hello. My name is Kelly. What's yours?"
She smiled at him.
"My name is Craig Dixon."
"Another Dixon? Did your entire family survive?"
She continued to smile as she asked.
"My mom died, and so did 2 of my aunts. My brother and uncles are alive in New Hampshire. We have to go find them when the snow thaws. Until the snow melts, we're looking for people like you," Craig explained.
"I'm sorry about your mother."
Kelly frowned as if she said something wrong.
"I'm glad you found me. There are 3 young kids, 2 girls and a boy, who will be very excited to meet you."
"Awesome," Craig said back.
"It is awesome,"
Kelly agreed, nodding. Her eyes moved from looking at Craig to something over his shoulder. Craig turned around to follow her eyes. She was staring at Hubba as the bulldog hopped down the steps of the RV. "That's our dog, Hubba. My Aunt Emily rescued him. He probably smelled the chili. He doesn't do much. Sleeps most of the time." Kelly had her hand cupped over her mouth. She moved out of her seat in the SUV and opened the door, running past Peter, Solange, and John as they moved toward the Suburban to leave. Kelly's hand was still over her mouth. Hubba's nose was high in the air, sniffing the chili. Kelly crouched down onto the tips of her toes and hugged the dog. Emily watched.
That's our dog, Hubba.
She paused.
Are you okay?
Kelly was crying, rocking and hugging the dog. Hubba licked her tears, finding something tasty in the young woman's dirty face.
I'm a veterinarian. I haven't seen a dog in half a year.
She turned and faced Hubba. The dog still licked her face.
You're a good boy. What a good boy.
Hubba's my miracle dog, for obvious reasons, but also because I found him on a house tour, half dead, locked in the governor's mansion. He's made a full recovery, as you can see. Hubba enjoyed the attention and the salty tear face. If he had a tail, it would have been wagging.
I didn't think I'd get to see a dog again.
Kelly smiled and backed away.
I can't believe you found a dog.
She rubbed Hubba behind the ears. Kelly, we should get going, John said from the driver's side of the Suburban. Hubba will be here when you get back. Trust me, he doesn't go anywhere. Kelly stood and looked at Emily.
Thank you. Thank you for coming for us. Thank you for feeding me. Thank you for having a dog.
She stepped forward and hugged Emily.
You're welcome, Emily replied, surprised by the emotion and embracing the stranger.
Kelly let go.
Okay, I'm off.
She looked down at Hubba, sitting at the feet of his new friend.
A dog. An entire family and a dog. Unbelievable.
She shook her head as she went back to the Suburban. So, you really like dogs, huh? John said, smiling.
I'm, or was, a vet. Large animals, mainly. Horses, really. I worked at the Aqueduct Racetrack and at Belmont Racetrack, and I volunteered for the NYSPCA a lot, too.
Sounds like an exciting job, Peter chimed in.
Kelly was suddenly at ease with the group, less reserved than she was before she met Hubba.
Well, most of the horse owners and trainers had their own vets. I was just on call. It's how I got the job at such a young age. I didn't get to do much. I've only been a vet for a year. I was the assistant vet, doing a large animal residency at the racetracks.
Well, we're glad to meet you. As I said, my name is John Dixon. My son Craig is behind you. Before we take off down Fifth Avenue, can you tell me where I'm going? I'm not from Manhattan. When you say Chelsea, I have no idea what you're talking about, other than knowing I can hit golf balls there.
Okay,
Kelly laughed. You're going to stay on Fifth Avenue until you get to Madison Square Garden. Take a right onto 21st, just past the garden. 21st goes right to the seminary.
And we're off, John said, as he put the Suburban into gear.
31. 11 more people, Todd said to Emily and Melanie, shaking his head as he watched the SUV drive away. This is going to cut into our food in a serious way. We can feast tonight, maybe for a few days, but we will need to stop in some towns and scavenge for food stores on our way to Boston.
We'll do what we need to do. I knew taking on more people was a risk, but think about the upside of having 24 people heading to Hanover rather than 7. We have 15 adults now. Let's get through the next few meals. We can figure out what to do.
Emily was not worried. They had enough food in the RVs to feed the group for a month. She also believed they would find food as soon as they left New York City.
And you picked up a doctor.
Melanie smiled, hinting she was part of the described upside.
I know, I know. I just worry about the food. We have enough.
He stared at the pot of chili.
We'll let the kids eat this chili now, and I'll get started on something else. How long do you think I have? An hour? Emily and Melanie shrugged their shoulders and held up their hands in the universal we-don't-know gesture. Matt was busy directing the younger kids in preparation for the arrival of the new group. He was tasked with setting up chairs, getting the other tables out from under the RVs, getting paper plates and flatware ready. They had two fire pits that needed to be set up and set ablaze. Matt pulled the kids into a tight circle around himself. "Okay, guys and gals, let's go eat and then be ready to help when the new people come to camp. Eat until you're full so you aren't thinking about food later. Great job on setting up the tables and making the camp inviting."
"Do we know if they like soccer?"
Brian asked excitedly about the kids coming to the camp. "No, we don't. I don't know their ages either." Matt answered questions as off the wall as they were.
"So there might be another little girl?" Casey asked hopefully.
I'm a girl," Jacqueline said quickly.
"You're not little, though, and you like sports," Casey clarified.
Matt jumped in to avoid a problem.
"I don't know the ages or whether they're boys or girls. I don't know if they like soccer either, but we will find out soon."
He handed bowls of chili out as the kids walked up to him.
"Are they going to come with us to Hanover like Jacqueline, Jacob, and Casey?"
Jay asked between large spoonfuls of chili. Soccer made him hungry, and he was afraid he would have to share his food with the new people.
"We don't know," Emily said as Matt struggled to answer.
"All we can do is be nice and ask them to come with us. They'll decide on their own." She patted Matt on the back and left him to run the group. Todd and Melanie were inside the RV preparing food. They ate bites of chili as they worked. Emily came inside to join them. Todd made spaghetti with meat sauce. It was kid-friendly and easy to prepare. The meal also saved well, allowing him to make more than he thought necessary and put leftovers in the fridge. He was not sure how much the new people would eat, and he prepared enough for an army.
"I wonder why they stayed in New York City if they didn't have enough food," Melanie said as she opened cans of green beans and poured them into a pot.
She always insisted on serving a vegetable.
"That's a great question. I don't know. Maybe they were trapped by snow until recently. Maybe they thought they had enough food to get through the winter and miscalculated. We'll have to ask them."
Todd placed two pots of water on the stove to boil.
"Kelly seemed nice for the 5 minutes we got to speak with her."
Emily looked out the window at the kids, who laughed as they ate.
"I just realized I haven't had dinner."
She opened the door and walked out to the chili, filling a bowl and grabbing two cornbread muffins.
"Who's ready to meet some new people?" she asked the table.
"Us,"
the group replied enthusiastically. Emily winked at Matt.
"I am too," she said. "I am too."
32. Rebecca turned the cottage's dining room into a project center. The bathtub was still next to the fireplace because of the hole they cut into the floor, but chairs were no longer stacked on the large table. A computer, books, maps, and charts were spread out in their place. Printouts and models adorned the alcove's walls. Inputting information was the new favorite pastime of the house. They had 8 laptop computers. 4 were plugged into solar chargers and placed near a window, while the other 4 were used to input data. Rebecca selected a topic for the day. She would simply say, "rainfall," and the group would input rainfall statistics from the past 25 years by month for North America. The days of copying and pasting large data sets from the Internet were gone. Inputting the information by hand was the new reality. Their use of the computers was limited. They would charge batteries on the solar chargers during the day and input for the 2 or so hours the battery life allowed. It was a frustratingly slow system, but it was working. They had climate, animal, insect, reptile, amphibian, and crop information inputted. They used thumb drives to move the data from each of their laptops onto Rebecca's master computer. Rebecca, Paul, Hank, and Greg discussed relevant statistics endlessly. The most subjective factor was availability.
What did that mean?
Could they realistically get to Australia if they needed to get to Australia? Was Okinawa a realistic destination? Was the Mediterranean? Days were spent debating their ability to move to California as opposed to Virginia. Should travel be incorporated into the model? Did moving 500 miles require the same effort and difficulty as moving 2,000 miles? The cottage did not spend all of their time working on the model. They had to survive. Greg had become a skilled trapper in the last few months. The shotguns and rifles were considered a finite resource, and the group relied more on trapping or bow hunting rather than bullets. They did not know how to fill shotgun shells or make gunpowder. The guns would soon be as obsolete as cars. As the weather turned warmer, they were able to fish. Soft spots opened on Occam Pond and the surrounding lakes. They cut holes in the ice and dropped lines. Hank and Greg spent hours trying to catch fish and game for dinner, while Paul and Rebecca stayed in the cottage working on the destination model. Hank and John were brothers, and they loved each other, but they were not close friends. They did not see each other outside of family events like weddings or anniversaries. The brothers drifted apart over the last 30 years, as did their families. As a result, Hank did not know his nephew well. They spent much of their time getting to know each other. Greg enjoyed his Uncle Hank. They had a mutual love of baseball and talked endlessly about statistics and players. Hank had seen most of the players Greg idolized. The snow was melting at the beginning of April. Hank and Greg enjoyed their first 45-degree sunny day and joked about how it felt like 80 degrees after the long cold winter. They drove a Jeep Wrangler to a trout club on the other side of the Connecticut River. A pier was left in the frozen lake, extending out into deep water. Using heavy rocks and long sticks, Hank and Greg made holes in the thinning ice at the end of the pier. They caught 5 rainbow trout using bait and hooks. Hank commented at how aghast his father would be if he were alive to see bobbers and bait at the esteemed Dry Fly Club. The lake was owned by a trout fishing club, tucked away in Norwich, Vermont, across the Connecticut River from Hanover. Heavy snow had prevented access to the lake except by snowmobile, and upon arrival they would have to dig a path onto the lake and use a chainsaw to cut through the thick ice. It was an arduous method for fish, and took the entire day to yield a few, if any, trout. As the snow melted and the ice thinned, the journey became easier and the fishing more rewarding. Now that Hank and Greg had better access, they fished the well-stocked lake often. Hank parked the Jeep, tricked out with large tires and giant treads, at the bottom of Wheelock Street. The street's intimidating hill was still covered in snow and ice. It was an invitation to wrecking the Jeep and injuring the drivers. They opted to walk the half-mile to and from the cottage each time they fished for trout. Today was their third outing to the trout club in the last week. Hank used the trip to the club to teach Greg how to drive. They practiced going to and from Norwich, sometimes 2 or 3 times each trip. "Don't get too used to driving. We're going to run out of gas, or the gas we have is going to go bad soon. Unless we find a person who knows how to refine oil, we'll be riding bikes and horses from here out," Hank teased. "I'm glad I learned to drive before cars become useless. I'll always be able to say, 'Back when we drove cars,'" Greg bragged. They finished the steep walk up Wheelock Hill and turned left on Main Street, heading to the cottage. The 5 large fish swung from the chain creel hanging from Greg's hip. They were friends, more than uncle and nephew, and talked about baseball as they made their way home. "I saw Randy Johnson pitch in Cincinnati. He was with the Diamondbacks and was incredible. First of all, he's like 8 feet tall, and he's only 60 feet away from you and standing on a mound. Then he's throwing heat that breaks. Then he's throwing a pitch with the same arm motion that's like 80 miles per hour. I don't know how the Reds batters put wood on the ball." Hank enjoyed talking about his baseball experiences. Greg soaked it up. "That's crazy. So he's the best you've ever seen?" Greg could listen to stories about baseball all day. Growing up in South Carolina meant he did not have access to the major leagues. Even though he spent the last year near Boston, he did not see any Red Sox games. "He was up there. I saw a lot of guys, though. Maddox would give up hits, but he never gave up runs, so he was totally different. He'd throw 80 pitches and be done in 2 hours. Such a rare pitcher. He didn't waste pitches. Hank finished his comments as they reached the cottage. It was noon, and he was hungry. Hank swung the interior mudroom door open and felt the warm, dry air blow out of the cottage. "The wood stove is definitely on," he said to Greg.
"Hey!"
Rebecca waved to them excitedly from her seat at the computer. "We've narrowed our move to a few places. I think we'll end up near the ocean in Virginia or make the long trek out to Northern California. I can't decide if earthquakes are worse than hurricanes. Both are about as likely. It depends on how long we want it to take to get to our final spot, and if we want to incorporate finding other survivors into our model."
"My dream of living in Hawaii is gone?" Greg lamented.
"It's too far. We don't have boats or planes. I mean, I guess we have boats, but we don't have anyone to captain the boat to get us there," she explained systematically. "So yes, it's over, Greg. Sorry." "I was so close. So close." He laughed.
"Hey, Rebecca, how's the morning going?" Hank asked. The angry, sad, paranoid man who arrived at the cottage 2 months ago was melting away, replaced by a happy and relaxed father figure. Rebecca's optimistic and infectious view of life was the leading cause of Hank's rebirth.
"I don't know. Am I eating trout for lunch?" she asked. Hank held up the 5 large fish.
"Lunch and dinner."
"Then I'm having a great day," she said with a smile. "Paul and I can tweak the model more, but I don't think the results will change. Greg is right. Hawaii would be our number one choice if we could get there. But given the travel limitations, California or Virginia are our next best options. Also, Hawaii probably means not finding new people."
"But if we can get to Hawaii?" Greg asked.
"Well, if we can get there, then we should go. Kauai has chickens, wild boar, fish, few insects, no snakes, no predators. It's always the same temperature. It always rains on one part of the island. It's always sunny on the other part. The growing season is 12 months. If we bring seeds and livestock, we could create a sustainable colony. Other than sunburn, it will be the best place to move. I can't see how we can get there without modern equipment. But if we can get there, pack your bags." Rebecca spoke with authority and confidence. Hank undressed from the morning expedition.
"Well then, let's switch our efforts from where to go to how to get there." He hung his fleece-lined flannel shirt on a hook next to the door. "If you say Kauai is where we need to go, let's figure out how we can get there. If you tell me we can't get there after research, I'll believe you, and we'll focus on California or Virginia. Let's give the Hawaii plan a good try."
"Another project?" Rebecca asked.
"Another project," Hank agreed. "Let's have some lunch first. Greg has exciting news."
Paul walked in the room from the kitchen. He looked at Greg with anticipation. Greg sat on the floor, pulling off his socks. Despite his waterproof and insulated boots, his socks always seemed to get wet.
"Oh man, does that feel good. I can't wait to not wear 2 pair of socks."
"Well," Paul asked, "what's the news?"
Greg smiled and looked at Hank, then back at Paul and Rebecca. "We saw the highway through the snow. We saw road down the valley. The snow is clearing. We can leave if we need to." He paused. "More importantly, people can come here if they try."
Smiles crept across the 4 faces. They beamed in silence, reveling in the news for a few moments.
"I say it's business as usual, but we prepare for other people to arrive during our spare time," Hank suggested. The comment elicited a chuckle from Paul.
"Yeah, all of our free time."
Hank brought the fish into the kitchen. He used olive oil, herbs, and seasoning on 3 of the trout before placing them in the oven for lunch. He packed the largest 2 in snow on the porch for dinner. Hank found several indoor herb kits at the hardware store when he first arrived and grew dill, basil, thyme, cilantro, and parsley on the kitchen windowsill. He used the herbs sparingly. They added a great dimension to fish and other foods. He typically used the abundance of dried herbs, but some things, like trout, called for fresh. Hank opened 2 cans of mixed vegetables and placed them in a pot on the stove. 15 minutes later, the fish and vegetables were ready.
The extreme heat of the wood stove oven and burners meant food was finished quickly. The group sat around the kitchen table. They tore bread from a large loaf baked that morning, ate their fish and vegetables, and drank water.
"We have at least a couple of weeks before John and Todd arrive," Paul began. "We've had a great few months, living as a little family here, but it's time to plan for our next phase."
He put some of the fish in his mouth and let out an audible,
"You've outdone yourself, Hank. The flavoring and preparation of the fish is getting better every day."
"Thank you, sir," Hank replied, "and I agree. We should clear the upstairs bedrooms of wood, sweep them, get them ready for occupants."
"We've used all of the wood upstairs. Paul and I have been filling the wood bins from the van supply for a few days. We do need to clean the upstairs. We have clothes and boots for newcomers. Let's focus on acquiring all the food we can find. Dried food, canned food, boxed food, anything we can move," Rebecca added.
Greg ate his fish, bread, and vegetables in silence as the other three made plans. It was too much for him to hope. He was a few weeks from seeing his father and brothers. It had been 7 months since he heard his father's voice, 8 months since he joked with his brothers or threw a baseball to Matt, 8 months since he sat around a table with his family and shared a meal. If he thought about it too much, he was overwhelmed. "Focus on the day-to-day," he often told himself. Greg felt a hand bump his leg under the table. It was Rebecca's. She squeezed his knee, and he looked up from his food to smile at her. She gave him a knowing look. They talked about his family all the time. She knew how excited he was to see his father and brothers. Greg slipped his hand under the table and placed it over hers. Hank and Paul laughed about some old story from their childhood in Hanover, while the teens held hands under the table.
33.
Kelly was shy and reserved at their camp, but a few minutes into the drive to Chelsea, she would not stop talking. All John, Craig, Solange, and Peter could do was nod and say, "Okay," and "Sure." "Obviously the racetracks were closed right after Raleigh, and I wasn't needed there. So I went to the SPCA to see if I could help, but all those animals died. One after another, they just got sick and died, faster than people did. And I'm sitting there saying, what am I going to do with my life? Horse racing is gone. Domestic animals are dead. Great career you've picked." But then, everyone started to die. Kelly stopped to drink a swig of water from a bottle given to her by John.
"Thank you for the water. You have no idea.
We started rationing water 4 months ago, unless you wanted to boil water from the river, and I am not drinking water from the Hudson or East River, no matter how long you boil it." She drank another swig. "Anyway, I was living on the Upper West Side with a girlfriend from college. We had this tiny one-bedroom, but we were never there. Except now we were always there, because neither of us had jobs to go to, and it's not like you wanted to go out into crowds or anything. So there we were in this tiny room together. My family was in Kentucky, which is why I love horses, and her family was out in Colorado, and neither one of us had a car, because we live in New York City, so we had no way to get home. Not that we wanted to go home, because everyone was sick anyway. Then Sarah, my roommate, gets sick, and I have to try and keep it together. And I stay with her, and we cry, and she dies, and I'm like, what do I do now? So I call the morgue, and they actually picked up her body, like, the next day. It was amazing. Nothing's running in New York, not the subways or the cabs, but the morgue service comes in 24 hours? Insane, right? I'd heard the stories about people who aren't sick, you know, disappearing. So before the morgue people come, I run up and down the stairs of our apartment building a bunch of times, get a good sweat going, get all flushed, and then I cough a few times. There was a woman with them. She was in fatigues, and she had a pocket thermometer, and I guess she's supposed to take my temp. She takes one look at me and decides I'm sick already. Kelly took another swig of water, and the woman says to me, "If you have the faculties and can call us when you get close to the end, we'll come by to see what we can do. God bless." See what they can do? She meant she'd pick up my body. Then she puts a big red Sharpie marker X on my door, and I look up and down the hall and see that all the doors have a red X, and a black X, too. I hadn't left the apartment in over a week, since Sarah got sick, so I had heard doors open and shut, but had not paid attention. Sarah was Korean.